I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Here's a job description for a kind of a job that a lot of people think would be a dream job, a professional food taster. What do you suppose would look good on a resume for this kind of a job? What would qualify you? Presumably a little bit more than just the mere fact that you've got some taste buds on your tongue. So here is a job description I have found. A professional food taster evaluates products and provides feedback for a food manufacturer, a restaurant, or another food production business. Primary duties include providing reports about food quality, including gustatory, olfactory, tactile, and visual experiences of food products to the manufacturer. Suggestions for improvement are expected from many professional food tasters. Responsibilities may also involve the evaluation of drinks. So there you have it. Maybe it's your calling in life to become a food taster. But for a little historical context now. Margot Volk had the task of trying food every day at 8 a.m., and if she did not fall ill, the food would then be sent to Adolf Hitler. And in ancient history, there are records of cupbearers and food tasters for monarchs, emperors, aristocrats. You know, the kind of people who could afford it or maybe force somebody into this employment. Food tasting it's still a thing even today among rulers and elites, but what we can hope is that it is not a thing nowadays to coerce people into this. The idea that somebody would unwillingly be forced to test food that may be tainted or poisoned. Alicia Rankin knows a thing or two about all of this. Rankin is a historian at Tufts University, and her newest book is titled The Poison Trials, Wonder Drugs, Experiment, and the Battle for Authority in Renaissance Science. She's on the line with us now. Alicia Rankin, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thanks so much.
Pardon the pun, but just how unsavory is this topic when people do you get reactions of people saying, ew, and that's nasty, and you've just ruined my fantasy dream job?
Yeah, I get a lot of, this is really gruesome, and how did you spend 10 years working on this topic?
Wow, that's a long time. But historians have got staying power to go through it. Are there lots and lots of records from back whenever about food tasters, or are they kind of a neglected class of people?
Yeah, the tasters themselves are totally neglected. We know so little about the people who are actually doing this task. What we do know is the theoretical side, what they're supposed to do, and the reasons why they're supposed to do it, which is to prevent a ruler from being poisoned.
So there's no memoirs out there, my life as a food taster.
I wish. That would have been really helpful.
Yeah.
But no.
Well, give us a time frame for the focus of what you're doing. I mentioned ancient emperors. I know clear back to Claudius, the Roman emperor, and even before that, the cupbearers of – well, even before history, we can presume this was going on. But you focused specifically on what time period?
So I focus particularly on the Renaissance, although I also give this – specific medieval background to that. So the Middle Ages, Renaissance are my period of expertise. And I was particularly interested in food testing in terms of what it said about the ability to test poison in general. So I was interested not only in food testing, but even more particularly for the whole book in the idea of poison as a particularly testable subject, something that you could, in fact, get an up or down test if something was poisonous or not.
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of thinking that in my layman's understanding of what happened in former times, this was all about the security of rulers, and it wasn't about the quality of the food. It wasn't that somebody wanted a good recommendation. It wasn't that there were food taster foodies back then. It was all about poison, it seems.
Absolutely. In terms of the food testing, of course, there is a whole other set of people who would have been responsible for making delicious food. That was also an interest of monarchs as well. But this there was a particular ceremony that was attached to it before the meals of many monarchs, where things would be laid out on a board. For example, the Italian word credenza, which is now an item of furniture, originally that came from the credence test of testing for poison. So the food would have been laid out, and the testers would have gone through and tested it to make sure that there was no poison in it.
There's a direct connection between that word credenza and the function of testing for poison?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly where it came from.
Yeah.
So the credence was this ceremony. It was this credence ceremony. And then that became referred to as the furniture that was put on, you know, became the name for it.
Yeah, that's wild. That's just wild.
Yeah.
Okay, so how did you stumble across the topic in the very first place? I know it may have been 10 years ago, but something put you on this road.
Yeah, so really my main interest in this book isn't so much food, although I ended up there in part of my first chapter, but this idea of testing poison in general, and particularly testing antidotes to poison. And literally, this topic was handed to me. I was doing archival research for my first book, which was on noble women who were practiced as healers in 16th century Germany. And I was in this tiny archive, which is in a castle in a small, small little town in southwest Germany. And so not that many people go to this archive. And the archivist was really excited to have someone there who knew something about 16th century German medicine. And he said, if you're interested in this, hey, look, there's this file here about a prince who tested an antidote to poison on a condemned criminal. And you might want to look at it. And I said, yeah, I would love to look at that. That's amazing. And this ended up being the entry into my book, because I learned as I did more research that this was actually a fairly common practice in the 16th century, that you would have princes who had their physicians give condemned criminals, so people who were already condemned to die, kind of poison, and then test an antidote on it. And the antidote would hopefully help the prince, if they thought, survive if he happened to be poisoned, because, of course, there was a lot of concern about poison in general at the time. So this interest in food testing sort of expanded into a general interest in trying to find not just food that wasn't poisoned, but antidotes to poison in case the worst happened and a prince was poisoned.
Now, there's so much there to talk about already.
Yes.
We could talk about the picking criminals and forcing them into this, and they're condemned to die anyway. I mean, this is practically Byzantine in some ways, to think about all of the ins and outs of. But can we go just to, before we get to the antidote thing,
yes,
can we go to the culture of people being very exercised about this whole idea that poisons are out there and someone's trying to get
mm-hmm.
you. Is there any way to gauge, was this more prevalent a notion in these times?
So this concern that princes had that they were going to be poisoned is age old. So this is definitely something that dates back to ancient times. And in fact, some of the earliest tests of poisons and antidotes that we know about come from ancient Persia. A king named Mithridates VI Eupator, who was famous for trying to find antidotes. But it was really acute in the Renaissance, where there is lots of political divisions, and poison was also very much attached to plague. So it was seen as a disease agent for plague. So not only would poison protect you from malicious poisoning if, you know, your enemies are trying to poison you, but it could protect your populace from plague epidemics, which were a continual scourge throughout this time. They came back every decade or 20 years. So an antidote to poison, was incredibly valuable against all of these things.
I kind of hear a conflation of fears where the people are afraid of the plague. The wealthy and the ruling class, they're afraid of being poisoned. And eventually it's just something's going to get you and we better have an antidote ready.
That's correct. I mean, I think a lot of your listeners can probably relate to this idea now, particularly having gone through the coronavirus pandemic, of having this unseen toxic force out there that might get you. And, you know, having something that you can use that is, you know, so-called proven against it is really, really valuable, because there just weren't really any proven drugs at the time. There are lots of rumors, but there is nothing that, you know, you could point to and say, this is the one thing that's going to help. So, you know, the same way that today we're sort of searching for vaccines as the one thing, they were looking for an antidote that would do that kind of thing.
Before we talk about any very specific stories from the Renaissance period or late medieval period, can we just kind of describe a marketplace? Because I understand there were markets just out in the open air where there were these purveyors of antidotes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the context of all of this is that at the time there was a hugely wide variety of healers, of medical practitioners, ranging from elite physicians who were university trained to surgeons who might have had some university courses to pharmacists who sold drugs in their own shops. But then a huge variety of unlicensed, untrained professionals who would just sell their drugs in the marketplace. Sometimes they received licensees to do them. Sometimes they just did it on their own and usually got away with it. But there, among these were often people who are called, there's a range of terms for them, empirics, empirical healers, charlatans, mountebanks. They were called in different places by different names. But they would do marketplace shows to try to hawk their wares, to hawk their remedies. And many of these remedies were poison antidotes or poison antidotes that were also allegedly good against a zillion other things. So poison antidotes and panaceas wrapped into one. And they would often sell them by doing these vibrant shows that involved self-poisoning sometimes. So they would be seen to take a poison and then cure themselves with their nostrum. Or sometimes they would poison animals and then try to cure them. But these were sort of dramatic shows involving poisoning and then curing. So Renaissance individuals would have been familiar with this kind of poison trial, as I'm calling them, sort of from the marketplace. So the fact that physicians tried to adopt the same kind of test to do on condemned criminals put the physicians in a bit of a tricky position because they were trying to separate themselves from these marketplace tests that were more they viewed as lower class and not, you know, not very well proven or legitimate.
This is all so rich because there are already tremendous parallels to what we see in today's market, where there
Absolutely.
Are – you got your certified types and you got the sleight of hand types. There's snake oil even today.
I sort of think about the physical marketplace in the Renaissance as similar to online forums today where there's just, you know, people who gained a reputation for being particularly effective, whether deserved or not. And then it was really hard for the physicians to, you know, push back against that because there was such interest. And when someone got a good reputation, it was really hard for physicians to go against that. Although I should say here in the Renaissance, the difference is that the physician's medicine was really no more effective than the empirics. It was all sort of equally effective or ineffective. So,
yeah, I wouldn't want to be living back then. That's not my cup
of exactly.
tea.
Yeah, and I do want to emphasize that all of the innovations I talk about in my book were innovations in methodologies, not in therapies. So none of the antidotes that they tested and, you know, thought to be effective were things that physicians would recommend today. So definitely do not try this at home.
Yeah. Well, I'm ready for a juicy story. Can you put a name on somebody? I think in your back pocket you may even have the story of a certain pope. I'm thinking of Clement. He comes from the which family in Italy?
The Medici family. So Pope Clement VII was a Medici pope. So he was from the storied Florentine Medici family, which ruled Florence off and on for several centuries. And he became pope in 1524 or 1523, and he was the first ruler that I have found in the Renaissance to have prescribed one of these poison trials on condemned criminals. So this phenomenon I talk about throughout my book really started in the Renaissance with Pope Clement VII, who heard about an antidote created by a local surgeon named Gregorio Caravita. And Caravita had this oil that had been used against plague. So here plague comes into effect again. So there had been a plague epidemic in Rome in 1523, and Caravita had allegedly used this oil to help plague patients, and he claimed it would also be good against any poison. So this remedy was brought to the Pope, and you might expect that the Pope would say, thank you, but I don't really believe you, go away. But in fact, Clement did not do that. He decided to have the oil tested. So he granted his physician, who was a very well-known humanist named Paolo Jovio, two condemned criminals to use for this test. And so they gave both criminals a little cake made out of marzipan mixed with aconite, so a deadly aconite called Nepalis. And it was supposed to be enough to kill, 100 men, not just two. And so they each took that, and then they both started experiencing terrible symptoms. And then one of the prisoners was given this antidote, this oil, which was an external. It was rubbed on different parts of his body, his temples and his heart. And then the other prisoner was given nothing, just to make sure the poison worked. So, which is one of the more gruesome cases. And so the prisoner who did not receive an antidote died in agony, and the prisoner who did survived and was fine. And then the Pope, as a reward, the Pope decided not to have him executed as he was supposed to, but instead sent him to the slave galleys, to row in the slave galleys, which, was supposed to be a reward. Yeah, so that was the very first case. They then decided that they might try this oil against a different kind of poison. So they found another condemned criminal who they were allowed to use and tried it with arsenic. And once again, it worked. And that one is particularly interesting because it was described that this physician and the apothecary, the pharmacist who was helping him, gave the prisoner the poison with their own hands. So they're really tying themselves to this process of giving poison. But he too was cured, and he too was sent to the slave galleys.
I'm just kind of interested in the idea that there was a topical application that was external rather than ingesting the antidote, at least in the story you just told.
Yeah, that's unusual. So most of them are internal remedies. But this particular one is external, and it has real religious resonances, so to holy oil and, rubbing it on the various external parts. But it was thought that these were the parts of the body that were particularly affected by poison. So they're seen as sort of the exit points of humors, into the air. And so the heart in particular, poison was seen as affecting the heart very badly. So it was all tied to the parts of the body that poison was seen as the most problematic for.
Well, I want to talk more about the methodology that you've mentioned, the idea that mm-hmm. this somehow is precedent setting for the way science is conducted or mm-hmm. has been. And we'll get to that in just a moment. I also want to talk about the idea that women in particular were deemed to be more likely than men to be going about poisoning people. we'll get to all of these topics in just a moment here. Time for a short break here on Constant Wonder as we're visiting with Alicia Rankin. She's a professor of history at Tufts University, and her newest book is titled The Poison Trials, Wonder Drugs, Experiment, and the Battle for Authority in Renaissance Science. Stay with us. I'm Marcus Smith, and you're listening to Constant Wonder. It's a pleasure to have historian Alicia Rankin with us. She is author of The Poison Trials, Wonder Drugs, Experiment, and the Battle for Authority in Renaissance Science. Before we get into the idea, Alicia, that that these tests on criminal subjects to see whether or not an antidote would succeed in obviating the effects of a poison, what's the story about women having a reputation in these times for going around poisoning people?
This is another thing that has ancient ties. So in ancient Rome, there was a sort of thought to be a group of women poisoners. And this idea tying women to poison was really prevalent throughout the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance. And poison was often seen as a crime of women, in part because they had access to poisonous substances. So often the poisons for household pests, which were readily available. So arsenic-based poisons were often used to kill household pests, so women had access to these. So there have been lots of historians who have done studies about whether women actually did poison more often than men, and they found, you know, if you look at the crimes women committed and crimes men committed, women do tend to poison more than men slightly, but it's just because men committed a lot more violent crimes. So the raw numbers are actually roughly similar. It's just that men committed way more crimes than women in terms of the actuality. But that's really beside the point, because in terms of the popular imagination, women really were tied to poison. And it was in some ways related to women's ties to witchcraft. So witchcraft and poison were really closely tied. So it's all related in this sort of triad, including the words that were used to describe both poison and witchcraft were similar and were really feminized.
So in a way, there's kind of a folklore going back to ancient mm-hmm. times. There, you say the popular imagination, but there's also mm-hmm. just sort of the circumstantial little bit that
exactly.
if you're living a domestic life, you're going to be in the kitchen, and kitchen is where you cook exactly. things up, and you might be cooking up poison.
Exactly. You have access to food, and you have also access to putting poison in food. So, you've got this sort of access that men don't have quite as much.
Yeah. Okay. Now, this is where it gets really interesting, I think, because you're making a case, I think, and you'll help me with this,
mm-hmm. Yes.
for the idea that as somebody like Pope Clement VII decides he's going to take criminals and have a control – and then, he's got two test subjects. So one gets the poison. I guess they both get the poison, but only one of them gets the antidote.
Exactly.
Yeah. This is precedent setting, you say.
Yes, and not so much this idea of the poison test with a control, what we might today call a control and a test subject. That actually, there is precedent for doing that on animals dating back to ancient Greece and Rome. But the methodology of trying to determine whether a poison antidote is successful that these physicians were doing, I'm arguing, were one of the various trends leading towards the development of an idea of experiment, of experimentation. Because in order to separate themselves from these marketplace practitioners, physicians had to show that their poison tests were different. And I'm arguing the way they did that was to try to use various methods to create a scholarly brand of experiment. And so this scholarly brand involved recording. So, an experiment needs a record, right? Or we don't know what happened. So carefully recording the symptoms of the poison itself, and then the symptoms of the antidote, and then, usually the result. Although actually in several cases, we don't actually find out the result. It's more, they're more interested in laying out the symptoms of what happened with the poison and the antidote. Sometimes it's very specific time markers of, the time of day in which various symptoms occurred. These are horribly gruesome cases, I should say. They're really difficult to get through. But it was just this fact of recording and careful observation, and then in some cases taking the results and using them to reconsider how to do a second trial. So I mentioned the Karavita's oil trial led, they tried it on aconite, and then they tried it on arsenic. In another case at the court of Emperor Ferdinand, Holy Roman Emperor Ferdinand I, they used one poison that just didn't work very well, and it took a long time for it to take effect, and everyone got really bored, and they sort of wondered if, this somehow the poison itself wasn't quite strong enough, and they had to give an extra dose. So to mitigate this, the next test they did, they actually withheld food and drink from the prisoner for a day ahead of time so that, as it specifically said, so that his body would be more receptive to poison. So this is horrific. Obviously would not pass the IRB today and is a terrible way to treat human beings. At the same time, in terms of experimental methodology, it was intellectually trying to take one result and then transfer it into reconvening the experiment the next time.
So the idea that an experiment is really only going to have any validity if it can be repeated.
Exactly. Yes. Or yes, that it could be repeated and that mistakes and experiments could be tweaked and corrected for the next time.
Now, I'm guessing that you already mentioned one instance where you looked at some primary sources, but are there primary sources far afield? I mean, are we talking just about Italy or are we talking about Germany and France? This whole practice kind of spread through Europe, I think.
Yes, exactly. So it began in Italy, and then one of the Italians who was present at this trial of Caravita's oil, who was a physician named Pietro Andrea Mattioli. At the time of Caravita's oil, he was a very young man, had just graduated medical school, but he eventually became very famous. He wrote one of the best-known medical books in the 16th century. He included, this was a book of plants explaining different kinds of plants and animals. It's basically an encyclopedia, commentary on a Greek encyclopedia by a Greek author named Dioscorides. Anyway, he moved to the court of Emperor Ferdinand I, and all of a sudden there you start seeing these poison trials pop up at Emperor Ferdinand's court. Because he had included records of the, and he updated this book constantly throughout his life, included records of this poison trial and then later ones that he conducted at Emperor Ferdinand's court. And because he was so well known and his book was translated into various languages, people read about these poison trials in different languages. And in France, the sort of having read Mattioli decided to try it there. So we have several other like unrelated cases in Germany as well. So this was mostly Italy, Germany, France, were the three main areas where you find these. But it's kind of all related to this initial case. It sort of kind of goes out in a web from there.
And do you suppose that people had any qualms about the ethics of this, even given the fact that criminals were used? I mean, was that kind of like their alibi? It's like, well, this person's condemned to death anyway, and so we don't need to worry about her, you know, the ethics.
Yes. That was the initial thought, but I have an entire chapter in my book about how that didn't actually pan out the way they thought it would, that it actually was, even at the time period when we think they could do anything they wanted to, a powerful ruler could do anything they wanted to with a criminal's body, actually that wasn't the case. It was ethically fraught, and it was a little bit ethically fraught for them as well, and not so much in just the practice of giving poison to another human being, which is what we would find ethically problematic, but in the practice of taking a criminal already condemned to die out of the normal practice of execution. So execution was a really ingrained cultural and religious phenomenon. It helped guide a criminal to a good death where he would hopefully go to heaven despite his terrible crimes, and also provide an example for justice, that provide an example that he had, you know, been punished for his crimes. So a poison trial takes him out of that. These are mostly private tests. They're not usually done in public. So it's sort of removing the criminal from this. And so in order to do that, they needed to have really good justification for doing that. So I show that there's two main things they did. First of all, they got the criminal's consent. And this is what shocked me in this book, that not so much in the Clement VII trial, but almost every trial after that, the trial records emphasize that the criminal agreed to take poison. And sometimes it even elaborates and says that they would much prefer to die of poison in prison than be executed in front of everyone, which was, in fact, seen as a really shameful thing and brought shame upon your family as well as yourself. So there's reasons why this might actually be true. But also they always emphasized that this was something done for the public good. So it wasn't just to preserve the prince from poison, but it could be used against plague or other epidemic diseases. So these two things, the consent of the prisoner and the public good, are the first two articles of the Nuremberg Code compiled after World War II. Which, you know, it shows the longevity. And there's a lot of research showing that these were two ideas that really became strong discussions in the 18th and 19th century, but they're actually found as early as the 16th century in the research that I have done.
You know, my stomach has turned.
Yeah.
how could it not, you know?
Yes.
But you see maybe there's not a direct – I mean, you can't connect the dots directly all the way through, but you see that there's got to be the origins of our ethical kind of system about what works and what doesn't and what we should and shouldn't do in experimentation. Even today, it kind of begins at this time period.
Yeah, I mean, it just shows that even at this time period, even when you think there's just no rules, that it really was difficult to conduct medical experiments that, you know, could involve death on human beings. Like, even at this time period, this was somewhat fraught and you know, involved at least thought, if not much more, about how to manage this. And it was really, the way they managed it was mostly semantic. They didn't change what they did, but it did require at least some kind of thought. The other main point is that poison trials really died out by the end of the 16th century. There is on humans, there is a lot on animals after that. But it was a pretty constrained phenomenon, and I think that's because it was really difficult to do this kind of test on a human being. You know, from the prince's perspective. I should also mention that a prince really did not want to be seen as a poisoner. So being seen as a poisoner was really seen as a lowly, scurrilous crime. It was secretive. It was something that was not honorable at all. So part of these semantics and trying to make sure that it was clear that the prisoner had agreed to take the poison and this was a public good was to separate the prince himself from being seen as a poisoner.
You know, of all the things you've mentioned, I think most interesting to me today, and we've already just touched on this a bit, but most interesting is the idea that even today, just about anybody can hang out a shingle and say, I have the cure. I have a panacea. Mm-hmm. I have a special elixir. I've got a potion. I've got a brew. And you can buy it from me. And even, you know, the sideshow aspect of you're in the marketplace and you're going to put on a little bit of a show and I'm going to poison this animal or I'll take it myself. And I mean, there's so much sleight of hand that's possible mm-hmm. in that. And then you say that back then, like today, there were efforts to kind of certify a certain group of people as you're the real practitioners who can be trusted.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, physicians were licensed, and they were licensed to do a specific thing, which is to do general internal medicine. Surgeons were licensed to do external medicine. Pharmacists were licensed to sell drugs. Those were sort of the big three, and midwives were sometimes licensed. There was a whole range of specialists who could get licensees. So in Italy, for example, charlatans, which of course today is a derogatory term, it was a job profession, it was a job description, and charlatans were extensively licensed for particular things, but it was usually to sell one particular drug. Throughout Europe, there were various systems to have people licensed to sell one or two drugs of their own making. So you could get actual official permission to do this. But then there were lots of people who never received permission who were doing it anyway. So it was, you know, partially a licensed, organized system and partially just a free-for-all.
And this licensure that you're talking about, is this the battle for authority that's in your subtitle?
The battle for authority is not so much the licensing, but the attempts of physicians to separate themselves and establish themselves as better than what they viewed as the riffraff. So these other practitioners who they viewed as the riffraff, but who had a lot of popular support. So I think it's helpful to think about physicians as being just a few people at the time. So it was really expensive to go to university. Physicians were mostly found in towns and cities. There weren't that many of them, so they're sort of, you know, yelling into the void as these other practitioners who far outnumbered them were selling, in many cases, much cheaper wares that they viewed as lowly and not effective. So they're trying to push back against that. So the battle for authority is between physicians and these empirical practitioners. At the same time, physicians were still really interested in what these empirics were doing. So it's this kind of, you know, internal struggle throughout the book where physicians are trying to establish themselves as different and more authoritative, while at the same time they're sort of peeking over the shoulders of these empirics, seeing if maybe some of their nostrums actually work. So the Caravita is a good example. He was a surgeon, but described as itinerant, so he moved around. So he wasn't, seen as one of the riffraff, but he also wasn't a physician. But they still, and his oil was alchemically created. So there's an alchemical theme throughout my book. A lot of these antidotes were either exotic imports from afar or alchemical creations that were local, and this oil was one of these alchemical creations. So it was, something that was new and untested, and so they were curious to see if maybe there was something to it. And that was this question throughout the book with these, empirical healers who are making these drastic, dramatic claims that we think now of, like, how could they even have believed that? Physicians were asking themselves, but what if there really is something to it? And how can we know that? And how can we take it over so that we can sell it instead of them also?
You know, years ago, there was a movie that came out. I don't know if you ever saw it. It's called My Big Fat Greek Wedding. And one of my favorite one of my favorite aspects of that movie is the father in the Greek family. He has his cure-all. It's Windex. He sprays it on everything.
Yeah.
And
I
want to see if I can tempt you to take off the historian's hat and just kind of comment as a person. I'm not going to hold you to any of the answers you give here. But is there something about human nature that you have observed in all of this? When you sit back and you think about these poison trials and the search for an antidote, and then that word cure-all, a panacea, the idea that people are hoping that there could be just one magic thing that takes care of it all, because I even know people like that today. I know people who have their own version of Windex, and it's good for everything.
I mean, this dates back to the beginning of historical records, right? There are so many examples of this impulse to find the one thing that's going to cure everything. And I think it's partially because the alternative to that is really hard, right? A cure-all is easy. You just take it and it cures everything, and it's wonderful. The alternative to that is these various mitigations of changing your diet, which no one wants to do, not in the 16th century, not today. taking maybe a mixture of different things, maybe trying to move your body more. So it's a much more complex answer if you have to, if you don't have a cure-all, what you can do to cure yourself, especially before antibiotics and, some of our more modern medications, is much more complicated. So, and I think even today, the cure-all provides an easy answer. And I think there must be something universal about that, right? Humans are lazy. We like the easy choice.
Alicia Rankin, it's just been a delight to have a chance to visit with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. This was really fun.
Alicia Rankin, an associate professor of history at Tufts University, and the book of hers we've been talking about is titled The Poison Trials, Wonder Drugs, Experiment, and the Battle for Authority in Renaissance Science. So it turns out the medieval world was not completely clueless. Heartless, often. But not clueless, not utterly lacking in intellectual discipline. And when we come back, we're going to look deeper into the recesses of medieval medicine, as well as into the history of the most famous medieval medical crisis. I'm talking about the Black Death, the plague. And we're going to discover that medieval medical thinking went beyond the usual suspects like bleeding or the four humors, leeches, that kind of thing. We'll be right back with more Constant Wonder. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Medieval practitioners of medicine were not completely in the dark the way we used to think. That's the theme this hour on our show. We're going to turn next to the greatest medical crisis of that era, the Black Death, sweeping through Europe and Asia from 1346 until 1353, and then surges of it later again. To learn more about how pandemics were handled back in the day, I spoke with Winston Black, a lecturer and adjunct researcher in medieval history at Idaho State University and Dalhousie University. A pivotal concept for Winston Black is the medieval notion that disease comes from miasma, from filthy air, and that one way to combat the bad air is to wear a mask with herbs stuffed inside, or maybe to hang sweet-smelling herbs or plant a lilac tree by the window. It was all about the air back then. And even though sometimes that can seem a little primitive, Winston Black argues that there were seeds of correct thinking in some of the precautions they took back then, precautions that bore some fruit.
Absolutely. I mean, that was one of the main ways they had to purify the air, because in the plague doctor's masks, the reason for the long beak is it would be filled with sweet or bitter smelling herbs and spices, which they imagined would somehow block or purify the air. And likewise, I don't know if they're using garlic, but stronger smelling things, actually, like wormwood or rosemary, strong smelling things you might still have in your kitchen to this day, were thought to possibly block that bad air. Or they may use something more drastic, burning pitch or petroleum to create a violent black smoke that's bad for us, but could potentially ward off the plague.
I don't know if this is in your line of work, but you probably have run into lists of what the apothecaries of the days had, the long herbal lists of whatever they shelved.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Pharmacists of the day are called the apothecaries, and the large ones in the cities could have hundreds of ingredients, ranging from cheap items, like I said, pretty much anything you could find in a well-stocked kitchen pantry today, oregano, thyme, rosemary. But just like today, we associate expensive with effective. And if you're wealthy enough in the Middle Ages, you want exotic spices. You want valuable things. So these are going to be cinnamon or ginger, which come all the way from East Asia in this period. Or if you're really wealthy, ground up pearls or emeralds. So we find sort of a financial hierarchy of cures that an apothecary could sell.
Have you stepped into a health food store lately?
It's not too different.
Yeah, that's my point. This is so similar to what, of course, I guess in the apothecary's day, those shelves, you don't just walk in and touch the products. You ask the expert to retrieve a bag of this or a bag of that. But this is very, very – I mean, all the talk about this or that herb will boost your immune system, that's the same kind of thinking as maybe 400 or 500 years ago.
That's exactly right. What's changed is simply the logic behind why you should take this or that herb or spice. Instead of a concept of boosting your immune system, they would say, this is for balancing your humors. It will strengthen your blood. Actually, that's a phrase still used in some health food stores. It will strengthen your blood, purge the bad phlegm or bad bile from your body, and bring you back into a state of balance.
Well, you just said purge. There's some word we use for detox. Isn't that what we
say
today?
Exactly. Exactly. And so, yeah, purging is one of the favorite concepts of high medieval medicine. The idea that you've got, well, they wouldn't use the word toxins, but the idea is that you have bad humors in you. And they would take medicines that would purge you, cause you to vomit or urinate, and get the bad humors out, bring you back into a state of health.
Well, I've been accused of bad humors, and no herb's going to fix it. I'm wondering if you could elaborate on this, because this goes back way beyond the Middle Ages. Doesn't this go back to, well, there's a long circuitous route where some of this information came from, because from Greece through maybe Africa?
That's absolutely right, yeah. More broadly, what we can call the humoral theory. This idea that all health and disease can be explained by the four humors in our bodies: blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile. And that dominates medieval medicine, but it really is the longest lasting medical system in the world. For over 2,000 years, from the time of Hippocrates in classical Greece, the Romans adopted it from him and other teachers. And with the rise of Islam in the Middle East and North Africa, a lot of Arabic authors also would take over this system of humoral theory, use it to explain their medicine. And then really, it's medieval Europe's a little slow. It's 11th and 12th centuries. They really pick up on it again, learning it from Arab Muslims. And it's not just medieval. It continues on into the modern period. Infamously, George Washington died because of humoral theory. His doctors gave him too many purgative medicines and too much bloodletting to try to balance his humors. So, for well over 2,000 years, this is a dominant medical system in Europe and the Middle East.
Well, if people are no longer given to using the word humors in their discussion of balancing things out, we've stuck with this verb to balance. Isn't there still, in my observation, quite a concern for keeping the body in some kind of balance, that this equilibrium? That's a persistent notion, and we have that in common with the Middle Ages.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Whether it's actually founded in modern medicine is questionable, but it makes sense to us. Balance is good, equilibrium is good. And we might not share the humoral theory anymore, but yeah, that language still surrounds a lot of popular medicine.
Anything like getting a good workout back then? You know
Come
what?
again?
Was there anything like getting a good workout? Yeah, they didn't have
Oh,
gyms,
yeah, physical,
they didn't have spas, but the idea that a healthy body will be a preventive measure.
That's something that is often surprisingly lacking in medieval medicine, in part because almost everybody was got a workout from having to, I mean, when most of society, 90% of people are agricultural laborers, they don't need a
I
workout.
get it.
But the doctors would prescribe what they would call a regimen. We still use that word today, where a proper balance of physical activity, diet, and medicines will keep your body in balance. And so they would have recommendations, not necessarily to do this or that sort of exercise, but to avoid things. So avoid battle, avoid sexual activity, avoid this or that physical act which might imbalance your humors. So they are thinking about what the body is doing.
I want to go to a distinction that I know that you're familiar with. The idea, if these humors are a problem for the body, if they're out of whack, if they're out of balance, those humors are something inside me. The miasma is something external to my body. Were medical professionals in those days, and just the conventional wisdom, was it focused on this division between internal problems, external problems?
Yeah, that's where we get some interesting, almost want to say clashes in the development of medicine in the later Middle Ages, especially during the plague. Because most of the medical theory, as you said, is based on this idea that sickness is caused from within you. They don't know about germs, so they're looking at an internal imbalance of the humors. But then when you get widespread contagious diseases, epidemics, pandemics, like plague, it doesn't take a scientific expert to look at this and say, this is coming from outside me. Entire communities are being wiped out. So they're looking for an explanation. Can both be true? The Middle Ages are great at that. They're good at embracing almost every theory and making them work together. So they would say, yeah, here we have a disease that is coming from outside of us. And one of their main explanations is that God has sent it. God is angry at us, and God works through nature to send a pestilence upon all of humanity. But they can keep their humoral theory going by saying, okay, yes, miasma is moving into your community, but you, an individual, are going to get sick because you have bad humors. And you have bad humors because you maybe have been living a sinful lifestyle. And they're able to get all of their systems of thought, religious, medical, scientific, working together to explain how disease happens.
Would a doctor have been on one side of a fence and a priest on the other, and I would have consulted one or the other or both? How would that have worked?
Generally, in the time of the Black Death, you could and should consult both. A good doctor, a good Christian doctor, would recommend first you should go confess your sins to a priest. But apart from that, the later Middle Ages was fully accepting of both systems of thought. I mean, one of the main explanations they would give is that God created the physical world with all of the healing plants in it. He wouldn't have done this if he didn't want us to use them. And God gave us the reason to study them and understand them. So you won't find any condemnation during the Black Death, say a priest saying, "Oh, stop going to the doctors." Now, they, of course, would say, "Yes, you have to make God happy. You have to confess your sins, purify your soul, but you can still go to the doctor." When we do see some complaints or condemnations, it would be about the greed of doctors. So, again, some things don't necessarily change. It would be the concern about what they're charging, but not about the actual use of natural medicine.
I'd like to conclude our conversation today reflecting on any legacies that are positive, that still stand up, or frames of mind, just a mindset or perspective from the Middle Ages that today, rather than being a negative legacy, is something that we've inherited that I'm not going to say it works medically, but at least it's moving in the right direction in terms of medicine. Is there anything along those
Sure.
lines?
Definitely. I mean, we were talking about the beaked masks of the plague doctors. They're often used as a terrifying Halloween mask now, but I think that's something we should look back on more positively as the beginnings of better understanding of contagion, of following medical advice about social distancing and covering your face and washing. One thing I should have brought up earlier when we were talking about sweet or bitter smelling substances from the time of the Black Death, they would very often recommend vinegar. Vinegar all the time. Drink it, wash with it, cover things with it. We now know vinegar has mild antiseptic properties. So they may have been onto something there as well. And I think finally, especially the legacy of isolation and quarantine. This very concept of quarantine comes out of the period after the Black Death, when several cities on the Mediterranean started imposing laws where they said, "We're going to shut down the city for 40 days." And that's exactly what quarantine means, quarantine, a period of 40 days. It didn't work because people, just like today, people break quarantine all the time. But they were on the right track. They're understanding what a society needs to do to work cooperatively to protect everyone to stop the spread of a disease. And they're doing this even without any microscopes or laboratories or germ theory. But they're on the right track.
Winston Black, a lecturer and adjunct researcher in medieval history at Idaho State University and Dalhousie University. After the news here on the show, American female nurses made heroic contributions while imprisoned by the Japanese in the Philippines, World War II. And when they finally returned home, they got no hero's welcome. Our next guest thinks it's time to fix that. We'll be right back. Stay with us.